turn around and look at Benjamin over there, who's taking our group photo. Not turn around, look to the side. What are we doing?
No, hold on. Then, no.
All right, everyone give Benjamin over there a big thumbs up. Make it look like you actually enjoyed this, even if you didn't.
Yeah, better be on the Carol. Free. Hood Bell C. Yeah, no, that's great.
It was super great.
Yeah.
It's okay. Axel, let me be on the count of three. Everybody to be like, give me like a Sal try and like a. Suck.
So, fantastic. Thank you. All right, so this is your chance to ask everything that you haven't asked yet.
And I've got some free questions.
And we've got some questions from the pre-survey and also some questions from the stream. So.
And just very quickly for both the audience here and
the people on the stream. So for both the audience here and on the stream. So after every summit, we send an email out with a questionnaire asking for your feedback. But what we're doing now to try to elicit more feedback from you all is Tracy just prepared a questionnaire now, which you can access through that QR code. So anyone who does it before the or by the end of the event today, people who are here who do it, so you put your name and email address in the questionnaire, we're going to randomly select two people from the event today, both in person and two people from the Zoom to get. So the people from the Zoom, we're going to select two people to get free Zoom access to the next summit. And for people who are here, two people are going to be selected for free weekend access to the upcoming summit, which will be in April 2026. Wow. Already moving there. Thank you. So you can just scan the QR codes up there. I'll put them on screen. And then later on, I think I'll put the QR code back for, we have an after party, which I will let Ziv explain after the Q&A. Yep. Thank you.
Okay, so just this is the mic that we need to pass between us, everyone, because that goes to the stream as well. So we'll start with, we'll let you guys process for a moment. Tracy can maybe start with the survey question or two.
No? So I'm just going to send, I just send it and I'm sending the survey now and it's going into your emails. So beforehand, we did ask a few questions and there was, I think most of them, I think have been covered during the last couple of days. Just a couple that we didn't really touch on. There was one which was interesting. Did you ever experience the bad vibe from a major real estate companies? I know we talked about being good buyers and making sure that when we are approaching real estate companies that we're being respectful. But what about in the other directions? I mean, and also, you know, bad vibes. I mean, we've got a couple of sort of bigger like real estate companies there. Was there any bad vibes from real estate companies?
Oh yeah, I've got one in particular. I won't name them. They're one of the, you know, traditional Japanese historic ones, very, very large. Their deals I've done around Yokohama and outside of Tokyo, the handful that I have done, they've been very friendly. But the ones in Tokyo, regardless of the branch that I've worked with, all their sales guys are just terrible to work with. They have zero care for the customer, both the buyer side or the seller. All they care about is their quarterly target. If they've met their quarterly target, they won't entertain offers. They don't really care. They won't even want to show it to you. They're in no rush to sell the property. If they are close to the end of the quarter and they have not met their target, they will be really pushy on the buyer side representative. Yeah, just settle, sign the contract by, you know, the 31st of the month. We've got to get that done. Or they're actually also very pushy on the seller. Just accept this deal because this is all we're going to get. The market's not talking. It's not good enough. Like, you have to accept this. This is the only one. And it's not really with consideration for the seller or the buyer. It's just to meet their quarterly targets. And I've seen it through so many of their agents in different branches. So I will gladly tell you the name of it, anyone individually. Yeah, privately, I won't announce it here. But it is one of the major Japanese ones with branches at almost every other train station.
I'll just slightly add to that, just because I know Chikako-san sitting in the back there is not going to say anything, but she has a list of agents. Whenever I show her a listing from one of those, she's like, no, we're not working with these guys. So some of the reasons are exactly what Emil's described, very pushy or completely non-responsive, depending on the time of the year. Other things that have happened is when we just started working, again, Chikako came up to say, well, this agent that I'm talking to just refuses to write anything in an email. Is like, whenever I talk to him, he's like, oh no, we need to talk on the phone because email can have misunderstandings, and just somebody who clearly doesn't want to commit in writing to anything. We've had other agents who just, you know, exploded and walked out of the room whenever we suggested that maybe something they're doing is not exactly in the buyer's interest. So yes, they definitely do exist. Anybody else? And any experiences like that?
Oh, real estate agent over there.
Yeah.
All right. So this is actually not me directly. This is one of my customers. So we closed this July, but last year, again, they were going, this is a foreign customer. They went with a local agency. That's a very large one. I won't say who they are. It's two words. It starts with O, but anyway, so, They were touring homes. They're looking to buy a house. And then it was a husband and wife. The wife spoke some Japanese. The husband didn't really speak. And then the agent drove him around, was barraging the wife with sales. And then it was three brand new houses. And then they parked the car outside the houses. They didn't have the keys. And then what they said, they were like, imagine the inside and decide. And these were 130 million yen homes. So like, you can't just like put an offer without looking at the inside of the home. But they're like, imagine and decide. And then so then they were so turned off that they complained to their friend, and the friend passed them to me. And then the next 3 weeks, you know, like this agent was calling the wife every single day. And then she was like ignoring him. And then finally on like the 22nd day, she answered the phone and he goes, oh, you finally answered. Are you ready to decide? And then she was like, no, don't call me again. But so Japanese agents.
Yeah, we often talk about all the things we admire about Japan. But one thing Japanese professionals are not always best at is admitting their mistakes, unfortunately. So there tend to be some emotional reactions when you point something like that out.
Just another couple more from the pre-survey. Thank you for everyone to filling that out. It is really helpful. I think we covered a lot during the last 2 days. What I didn't hear anyone discussing was natural disaster coverage. There's taxes, which I think we went into, but insurance we didn't really touch on. So anyone? I know I have for minpaku, if you're doing minpaku, make sure that when you have a minpaku, that your insurance policy allows for different people in and out. It's different from normal household insurance. You do have to, it's not that much more expensive, but you just need to make sure that the insurance policy is that you're covered if there is any damage or any, you know, like fire or any damage, they need to know that there are different people coming in and out. For human liability, like for personal liability, you can join the Minpaku Association, and for each house it's 30,000 yen per year, and that will cover personal liability. So this is for guests. So guests who die or, you know, whatever, that's covered in the Min. But that's with the, you join the Minpaku Association, which is a federal one, it includes it's 30,000 per property. So Nega?
Oh, let's.
Nope.
I'm some small guy.
And usually a normal fire insurance covers most of everything. And I know people they bought cheap houses. They're covered through like a normal cheap fire insurance. A typhoon hits it, throws the roof off, and then they get 30 million yen in coverage to like build a brand new house. So like a normal fire insurance is something I think everybody should consider. An earthquake one is regulated by law, I think. So it's a standard fee, but that you can really decide if you want it or not. But like a normal fire insurance is cheap and
it's different for business. So.
Yeah. It's very cheap. I can't find one of that business.
Yeah. So typically what I do is it's all new build. With bank financing, you must buy a fire insurance. And fire insurance, usually we typically provide two options. One is with water damage compensation. The other one's with all water damage compensation. You can choose, depends on which zone your house is located at. If it's zone prone to flood, maybe you can add on water damages, but if it's not, it's really at your own choice. Typically for like a 90 million yen cost of building, first 5 years, it's only about like $3,000. So each year is pretty reasonable. It's only 500-600 or so for the lowest option. But if you want to add more, like I usually wouldn't typically recommend earthquake insurance. It's quite expensive. It's different, completely separate from the fire insurance. Because fire insurance is usually just pretty reasonable, whereas earthquake insurance has a really high premium. Although all the new built typically consist in level 8 earthquake. So for new build, you definitely don't need earthquake insurance. But for older ones, you do probably want to consider earthquake insurance.
The insurance carries the sending if they're going
to
do business.
One thing to bear in mind, I'll give it to you in a second. One thing to bear in mind is that earthquake insurance will cover normally, unless you opt for more expensive coverage options, but normally it would cover up to half of the estimated value of the structure in case of a total loss. Tsunami, which is caused by earthquakes, falls under that as well. Everything else is normally covered up to 100%, but how they calculate that depends on the official evaluation, not necessarily to do with your market price. So it can be higher, can be lower, depending on how much you purchased it for. One other thing that we add for all tenants, if we have long-term tenants, we used to only do it for elderly tenants, and then we had somebody who was, I think, 48 or something, pass away in a property. So since then, we get the landlord insurance, or as we call it, death insurance. Different terms from different providers, depending on how many properties you've got insured with them. But in our case, we get up to 1 million yen for the expenses related to a death in the property, and then up to 2 years of missing or lowered rental amount, right? Because the next tenant in line, you will have to charge a little bit less if they know, and usually they will know that someone's passed away in the property. So that's a really handy one to have. And it's only 6,000-7,000 yen a year. It's well worth getting normally.
And just to give you some real numbers on insurance prices for my properties in Tokyo that I do, because most of the properties I deal with, as Alicia was saying, they get financed. So one of the requirements when you get a home loan on a property is that it has insurance on it. And we do like the Kasai Hoken, which is a fire and fire insurance. And the earthquake insurance is also combined with it. Generally for a standalone house, if just say it's 30 million yen, so 3,000 yen of building value coverage, and say 5 to 10 million yen of furniture and contents insurance, is about 80,000 to 100,000 yen per year for that coverage. That includes fire and earthquake. For a mansion or a condo, it's about maybe 30,000 yen a year for a similar kind of coverage. The earthquake portion is, as Anton was saying, by regulation, covers 50% of the regular valuation. So the regular coverage. So as I said, it's like the building is maybe 30 million yen is the coverage. The earthquake portion will be 15 million yen. And in case of an earthquake, what happens is the ward will assess, is it a level 1 damage, level 2, or level 3 damage? And level 3, for example, is full rebuild requirement. So based on the ward's assessment or the inspector's assessment on, is it a category or level 1, 2, 3 damage, you get paid out, 20%, 50%, or 100% of the 15 million yen earthquake coverage. That earthquake portion of your bill is actually a tax deductible expense as well, though. So earthquake insurance portion of your insurance bill, you get a letter every year which you submit to the tax office, and you get, let's say it's like 40,000 yen or 30,000 yen worth, that's a deductible tax expense. There's a specific line item in your tax return. That's for standard homes in Tokyo that I deal with for some real pricing.
I think that's to save you from thinking about all these numbers. Just bottom line, insurance is super cheap in Japan. Just get the maximum coverage that you can for any case that you can. It's well worth it, I'd say. Do we have questions from the room, by the way? Do we keep going with this? Okay, we got one over here and one over there. Let's do it over there. So if you have questions in the room, if you could just line up behind Robert there or behind that microphone, and then we won't have to give you the speaker's mic. That'll be super handy.
Okay, can you hear me? Yeah, good. I already asked this privately with Emil and also with Alicia, but I wanted to throw it out to the panel in case somebody knows. In Australia and in the US, as a home loan owner, a homeowner with a home loan, I can get an equity line of credit to draw money out that I've already paid into my home loan to then reinvest elsewhere. So if I've already paid $10,000 worth of home loan, I can pull $5,000 out and then invest that elsewhere at a higher interest rate. Is that possible in Japan? Alicia and Emil have both said, no, look, probably not. Has anyone had any experience with this?
Yeah.
Microphone right there.
They'll take this.
So that's...
Oh, no, that's happened. This one. All right. Sorry. Because of the string.
So that's something a Japanese investor would call back financing. People do that.
I don't mean a second mortgage or a second loan. I just mean drawing money out that you've already paid in at the same interest rate that you're paying for the home loan, like we do in Australia and the US. Well, if the bank so wishes, yes. So yeah.
Cash purchased houses and apartments into collateral in order to free up cash and buying something else. Does that make sense?
Once again?
It's different. And I think that's what Ziv was.
Yeah.
But I've never heard anyone doing that. I've heard people taking out, instead of doing that, I know that people would take out renovation loans and it's about the same effect, I would say. So let's say you buy a house for 10 million, you have 8 million in loans and you're paying off the loan, and instead of mixing with the loans, because every time you're trying to pay off a loan that you already have, there's usually a 1.5 to 2% penalty fee if you're paying it off earlier than they expect, if it's a 30-year loan or 35-year loan. So I would recommend you, if you're trying to do something like that, I would recommend you to take out a new loan as a renovation loan, and usually they are very low interest. But I wouldn't mix with the banks.
Okay, so that's a second loan then, really, and I have to go through the whole loan approval,
yes,
et cetera. Exactly. That, I'm already overextended, so that wouldn't work here. No. The other one would be refinancing, as someone mentioned here, with the same bank, refinancing and then hopefully being able to draw out there. But that's a whole another mess. Or go with another bank, and then that's a whole other process. No, I thought it would be easier to do what we do in Australia and the US, is just to draw out money that we've by an
equity. I've never heard anyone doing that. And usually, if you're not paying off the entire loan at once, I've never heard about anyone paying off 20%.
No, but he means, as you've already, for example, in a period of 5 years, you've paid off.
So we can't draw equity out.
Yeah, usually it's not.
Equity line of credit.
I've been discussing with the new money lender. I just had a meeting with them about 2 weeks ago or so. And what they will do, if you own cash, like your property outright, they will let you borrow that back. Like, and they are, their focus is like non-resident. They do non-resident financing. And so you don't even need a bank account or residency in Japan. It's a new setup. It's not a bank. It's a different kind of lender. Their interest rate's about 4%. So it's not suitable for people that are resident here with access to lower rates. But for example, I've got a guy, he bought a 200 million yen property in Azabu with cash, a US guy. And so now the offer is, well, you know what? You can get 60% back. They'll finance him 60% of that property. So it's at 120 million yen. He can now get that back and his interest rate will be 4% from this financer, which with that money in the US, he can do better than 4%. So for him, we're offering that and that's attractive to him. So there are situations where if you have a cash property, I think Anton did something similar in the past. If you have something that's paid outright, already you fully own, you may be able to mortgage that and get some cash. But when there's already, you know, you just built up equity in an existing property and there's already bank financing on it, it's hard, I believe, to get
a bit of extra cash out of the equity that you've put into it.
Okay, thank you.
We do have a question for the stream and from Tracy. So if anyone in the room wants to ask questions, again, if you put just mine up behind the mic, get them asked for you.
So one question from the stream is, how can investors participate in ways that strengthen local communities, support family life, and align with Japan's long-term social and demographic goals?
Tracy?
I'm a huge, believer in getting in touch with your local community. I'm in Tokyo, and there's Chōnai. So I'm a member. I know the local tanto, Akiko, help me out. It's the Chōnai, like Imai-san, right? So they run the local community, the community activities. They do the festivals, and so every year I buy a lantern. I make sure that's in the diary. We give them a call. We buy the lantern, and that goes a long way because people talk, and because it's almost like a mini chamber of commerce. And they're usually old people and they have nothing better to do with their time. And so they chat. And so when people are saying, oh, who are these foreigners? Who are, who's this business? The word gets around it like, they're the good kind, they're fine. And so that does my marketing for me in a lot of ways. And so that really does smooth the way with the community. So find out who is your local, who's your local tanto, you can actually just go to your city office and find out who is the community leader. Go and have a cup of tea with them. Take them cookies, make friends. Yes, it's pretty nerdy, but it does pay off in the long run. We do this in a lot of communities. I've just helped a client who was buying in Shizuoka area, and they had to, they had the, again, I've forgotten the Japanese. It's like the jikko nantaka. So they had to go to their local community meeting with all of the and almost like get permission to do minpaku. So if you listen to my talk today, I showed that I have a vision statement and a mission statement, and I have that translated. And then I also have a letter that I drop around to all the neighbors, again, with some cookies and a smile and your meishi. It just goes a long way, just to show that you're doing your best and you're the right kind, and that you're trying to be involved in your community. Make friends with your mum and dad, noodle shop, because in our business, it's great because my guests want to have that community access. They want to know where are the shops they're going to get a welcome, because not all small businesses are going to welcome your guests. But if I tell them the shops that they're welcome at, it goes a long way. So I went into a yakitori place the other day. The master was there. He basically falls on the floor and just says, your money's no good here, your money's no good here, because I send so many guests to him. And he's just so excited that he gets all these, he doesn't speak a lick of English, but he just thinks it's hilarious that he gets so many tourists that come in. So he's the kind of people that I want to deal with. And again, the people talk, and that's going to do your marketing for you.
I can talk a little bit about
this. Yeah, we go.
So not everything that I'm doing in the States might translate to over here in Japan, but being an active member of our community has been really important for our company. So we're doing things like sponsoring our local sports teams, local charities, maybe having auctions. And so we'll donate stays and they will auction those off. And kind of the upside for that is I'm getting that publicity that we're donating to these charities. And a lot of people never actually use those stays. And so I get the publicity and I get the traction. And then a lot of times I never actually have to follow through on those stays. Mm-hmm. I'm posting on social media about the different coffee shops that I'm going to. And we have relationships with some of our local coffee shops and restaurants where our guests get cards. They're like little business cards. And it says, it's our treat or coffee on me. And our guests will take those cards to our local coffee shops, hand them over. And the staff there goes into an envelope where I have a gift certificate already staged there, and they'll just swipe it and I'll cover the first $5 of their coffee order. And not all of our guests use it, but it's still something I'm providing for them. And it's driving so much traffic to our local restaurants. It's all of our blog posts where, and those are listicles, which are great for SEO and for AI. As it's scraping data, I'm sending people to all of these restaurants and I'm posting about it on social media.
I do it. I do that all the time as well. So, there is one more from the Brie.
Yeah. So how to find the best Minpaku property managers for a given area. Believe it or not, Chai and I are not the only game in town. We're two of the best, but we don't cover the whole country. The best way to find a good Minpaku property manager is to interview them. Like, look at, go on to the OTAs, have a look in your local area, who is there, have a look at their reviews, reach out to them. You can contact them through the OTAs, and say that you are interested in having someone represent your property, but interview them. Find out what their values are, find out what their mission statement is, their vision statement, what are their high touch hospitality opportunities, and then see if their goals resonate with what your goals are. So it's not that things are, one company is worse than another. It's more about just finding the right fit between what you're trying to achieve and what they're delivering.
Yes, absolutely.
100% correct, but I will just add that in some areas that are not big cities like Tokyo and Kyoto, and there are only going to be a handful of Minpaku management. For example, we've got customers regularly asking for Minpaku management companies around Miyoko, Nagano, Niigata, whatever the case may be. If you're not resident in Japan or don't speak the language and or have a foreign name even, sometimes they will be hesitant to reply or work with you. A lot of these companies can cater to foreign guests in one way or another, but they have no idea how to deal with a foreigner landlord as a customer. So it's sometimes worth, that's a service that we provide to our customers, is to help research these kinds of Minpaku management companies, contact them, inquire as to what services exactly they can provide, promise them, like we often do with agents as well, that they'll never have to speak to the scary foreigner on the other side. There'll be somebody handling the relationship on their behalf. It just gives you a better chance to actually nab one of these, because again, in some of the more rural areas, there's only going to be one or two or three of these companies who have never worked with foreigners before. So there's not that much picking and choosing to do in those areas, unfortunately.
Oh, I just want to add one thing. I'm a bit of a hog on the microphone. But the cheapest game in town is not necessarily the best game in town. So, you might one property manager might offer you 15%, another property manager might be offering you 25%. Look at how much you're going to get in your bank account because at the end of the day, just because you feel like you've squeezed them for a couple of percentage points, that don't pay the bills, right? You know, what is going into your bank account at the end of the month should be your bellwether of who is going to be the best property manager for you.
Sorry.
And actually, if you know you're going to do STR, try and find manager and talk to him, book a consultation before you actually close on the property, because only in the past 3 months I went on property inspection to two properties where the owners were basically a day, 2 days before closing on the deal. They did not talk to a property manager. They had no idea what's going to happen, if they even can or cannot do STR in that area, what they need for it, if the house is in that case even suitable for the STR. So if this is something that you are considering doing with the property you are buying, book your consultation before. I think people like Tracy, they offer maybe 15 minutes for free, just that kind of first consultation. So do your due diligence and actually book it before, not after.
Hello. I'd like to add a couple of things on that. So management companies have different flavors. Like, for example, we do a lot of the traditional houses. So if that's what you're interested in, you might like to look at management companies which specialize in that. If you have an apartment, maybe it's, you know, another management company that's better suited to your needs. And then the next point I'd say is that in Kyoto in particular, many of the companies are not particularly international, actually. So, you know, we have some people coming across to us who want our international type style, and perhaps other people are less inclined to require that. And thirdly, in terms of the management fee that Tracy mentioned, some companies like to stack on a lot of additional fees on the back end. I've seen that before. And we try and keep it quite simple, but some companies like to make it rather complicated. So yeah, just check that as well.
Any further questions from the room, from the stream? Yep. Yeah, so go ahead.
Sort of a general question, sort of related to that streaming question about the communities. And Anton, you mentioned about flipping houses and stuff. And I'm from Canada, where the last like 20, 30, 40 years, Canada's economy has a lot been based on speculative, irresponsible real estate investment. Probably people from maybe Sydney know the same thing. And it's caused a lot of societal issues, most notably unaffordability, where like teachers and nurses and local people have hard times living in their own city. So just wondering, like, do you see that kind of thing happening in Japan? Like, maybe Emil, you have a good sense of this living in Tokyo. Like, do you see speculation ramping up? Is there enough government regulations and stuff to kind of hold this type of thing back? Or just want to get a general feel.
So that question about, you know, is, I think how I say it is, well, is the increased price of real estate due to speculation pushing out or disrupting communities, making it harder for people to live. And I think in Tokyo, in central Tokyo, all I can really speak for, yes, definitely we're seeing that is the case. Prices, you know, I use one good example because I see the exact building. 3 years ago, a client bought it for 155 million yen on the 15th floor with the Mount Fuji view in Shirogane. And now the 19th floor, so exact same corner apartment, just four stories higher, is listed for 250 million yen. So it's 100 million yen capital growth, let's say, and it's 60% in 3 years. And we're seeing this in a lot of these properties in the Minato-ku area, Chiyoda-ku, and like these very central pockets. And there is reason for that. It's not just speculation. You know, you said 30, 40 years, I'm from Melbourne, Australia. So we have similar to what's experienced in like some of the Canadian cities as well. 30, 40 years of consistent property price growth. Is that speculation or is that real? You know, it's really happening. And I think in Tokyo in particular, it's not just, they say it's in part speculation, but there is lots of money, lots of development that's happening. Azabudai Hills is a massive complex. It's, you know, billions spent on that. Roppongi Hills 2 has been approved now, and that's been 30 years in the making just to buy up that land and get permits. And now that's going to be under construction, and that's going to be bigger than Roppongi Hills and in between Roppongi Hills and Azabudai Hills, right? So there's lots of money going into that area, and there's no land available for ordinary sort of properties. So yes, prices are going up, I think, because market is, it's not just speculation, because of real market demands. However, I do think there is an issue with speculation, and a lot of it has been these foreign investors doing cash flips, especially for brand new builds. They'll buy it. It's like a lottery to enter, and whoever gets it, if it's sold for like, you know, 150 million yen, the resale market immediately after is 200 million yen. So they've made, you know, $500,000 almost just by winning the lottery. Harumi Flag, which was the Tokyo the Olympics athletes village that they were selling. I think some of the top properties on the top floor, there were like 250 applicants for each of the properties. And the lower level floors, which weren't as popular, was like 30 applicants for one property. And these were already had finance vetting. A lot of people were applying with using their friend's name and multiple names, just because the flip market, even before settlement, was a massive jump. And the government has said recently, I believe there's one ward in, is it even Chiyoda-ku, has said they're going to want to put developers on notice of these tower mansions. Say you, they want to request that buyers don't resell within 5 years to prevent that speculative purchase that is exactly driving up prices and making it harder for locals to buy in their own area. So I'm seeing that now with my clientele. What used to be 100 million yen for a 2 or 3 bedroom in central Tokyo is now a 1.5, 2 bedroom place. And a 3 bedroom is now 200 million yen plus. So now they're getting, well, they can't live inside. They have to go further and further and further out. Exactly what you're seeing in other cities, in particular the past 5 years or so, we're seeing now in central Tokyo. Another thing the government has said to prevent this is further restrictions on foreign ownership. I believe, Shu, you did a video on that about just recently about Japanese government is talking about restricting foreign ownership, because right now Japan has just no rules at all. So I do support some sort of initiatives for that, but right now there's no real government regulation. What Chiyoda-ku imposed is just a request for developers to request buyers not to sell within 5 years, but there is no penalty or at this stage imposed to either the developer or the buyer. It's just a kind request, which may not work with foreigners.
Anyone?
So regarding buying akias or businesses from owners, what is the possibility of the owners accepting a financing option?
Owner financing.
As in, you would pay in installments over a couple of years.
Owner financing. So like here, instead of a bank getting a loan from a bank, you pay the owners becoming like a bank, right? I've never experienced it. All the transactions that I've been involved are all cash. So I know in the U.S. That's a creative finance. I think it's called creative financing. So it's pretty common. So Chai has an answer.
Chai has an answer. Yep. Down the line.
Yeah, so actually last summit, Jason was kind enough to share that he successfully did some owner financing. So I'm currently trying to do it as well. So so thanks for that, Jason. But yeah, I think it's possible if the owner accepts it. So yeah.
So I have a client who is recently, I proposed this method of owner financing because his property is up in the Niseko. No bank was willing to finance him, but I was able to convince him, if you want to sell it more easily, right, because it's quite expensive property, he agreed to financing 40% of the property. If anyone's interested, we'll schedule an interest rate of the 40%, interest rate on the 40% payment over 25 years. So it's really about like between the seller and the buyer, however they want to structure the sale.
It's not common though, right? I mean, introduce the idea, it's not like they heard about.
Right, it's not common, but definitely you can educate your seller, right? That's one way to sell your property more easily. And then top on that, you save a lot more taxes on the capital gain if you have like a huge appreciation.
I am going to say, for the most part, though, anything that's really non-standard is going to be hard-pressed to get acceptance in the typical Japanese market. I even believe there's one question here about patience.
Yes.
Which maybe falls in line with that.
Yeah. One of the questions that we had was advice on how to learn patience in a society where everything seems to take a very long time.
No one will find that.
Yeah. Anyone want to speak to that?
Oh, Anton.
I think it ties on to the previous question. And I think Japan is a place where, to me, if you're trying to make things complicated, you're getting nowhere. And I think it's about making it easy, as long as it's an Akia and financing for Akia. It's a problem, most cases, that people want to get rid of. And then tying that into seller financing and financing of some sort, you don't get away from the problem, I think. So I think you just got to be here and learn and study and be curious and learn Japanese and just try several things. If it doesn't work, respectfully, you change tactics somehow and just make it easy, really, I think. Maybe Charlie has something to add on this one.
The patience.
Patience.
Yes. Yes, it takes a long, long time. I just wanted to add that my solution to that, which doesn't always work, but at least some of the time, is just get yourself a Japanese partner. If it's not a spouse, a business. I'm a spouse or business partner or both. Somebody who can, like in my case, you know, we're sitting in a meeting and Chikako would go, wait, hang on, he's still talking. It sounds like he's not, but he's actually still talking. He's pausing. It's a very different pace, and it takes a lot of time to get used to it, and even more time to not become frustrated by it. Sorry.
Brett has a comment.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
Sorry, it just made me think of, like, one of the most common things that we have to do during education is setting expectations. So patience comes from probably a misalignment between your expectations and reality. So if you have improper expectations, then everything's going to feel like it's slow and you're going to run out of patience very fast. But if you expect something to take 6 months and it takes 5 months and 3 weeks, great, it happened fast. But if you expected it to be done in 3 months and it takes 6 months, even though it's the exact same thing, you're going to feel impatient. So it's really about having your expectations set before you come into things.
My little gag. I feel the Japanese government now, permanent residency application, anyone who knows, it used to be 5 or 6 months, and now it's like 18 to 20 months. And I think they may be doing that just so, hey, if you want to be a permanent resident, we're going to teach you patience the long way. That's my 2 cents.
Warren.
Hi, this is more a question that I originally was going to ask during Anton's thing, but I think it's probably good to ask in the wider audience. Or do you guys have any stories of where you were trying to get like a permit for something and whatever you tried, it didn't work, and then you have to do some creative solutions to get around those? Or has that ever been a hindrance where you couldn't finalize the deal for a client because of that inability to get a certain permit approved?
I think I haven't, in the end, I've always gotten the permits that I wanted to get, but it's because you do your like back research if it's possible or not. If you just buy any house without doing your due diligence and then you expect yourself to be able to get a ryokan license or whatever license you want. But in many cases, it's a lot of gray zones. So they were kind of, if you're cooperative, you're respectful, and you want to get here, it requires a lot of work in many cases. But like, if you do the work, you'll get there. Like, if you do your due diligence, but it's going to take time.
When you're going for permits, and the good thing about Japan is that it's all very transparent. Like, if you want to go and get a ryokan license, you want to get a minpaku license, whatever, you go and you find out what the checklist is and you go through the steps. And as long as you can show that you have met the criteria for each spot, now then you're giving that bureaucrat the deniability. So like they're never going to have to explain their decision from someone else. So if you give them the out, if you are able to show that you're following all of the checklist that has been provided by a higher person, then they will give you the license and the permit. So make it easy on them. There's no wiggle room. There's no, you know, charming smile, like a little wink and a nod. There's nothing like that. So you, as long as you're able to give that person the ability to not have to explain their decision, then that's how you go. That said, You can be creative in how you can check that box. So I've had inspections where I've had to have a tablet on site, and I actually don't have a tablet on site full time, but they've been able to check the box to say, yes, tablet tick, or the especially Suginamiku is a little bit fussy when it comes to the security cameras, in that you for a ryokan license, you need to be able to show a feed from 24 hours ago and the feed from today. It worked for 5 minutes. It was like we had to hack this. My brother is a software guy. We had to hack the system to show that we had them side by side. It worked for 5 minutes. And then when they left the office and like they ticked the box and they signed it and they were out of there, it stopped working. It fell over. So they were able to go back to the office and say, yep, we saw that working. We saw the tablet on site, and then their job was done. So remember, they're civil servants. They don't want to take a risk. They don't want to have to explain themselves. So make it easy on them. Know what the rules are, but there's no wiggle room. There's no, you know, there's no way that you can get around it, but make it easy on them.
I think when we talk about permits, there's like the two things that I think of here are, if you're buying a place for that, maybe you want to do it as short-term rental, then you need to qualify that property in advance with the ward office, make sure it's in the zoning and whatnot. That's one requirement. The other one that we're going through right now is, in terms of permits, is for a brand new house build. So we got a guy right now in the process. I was messaging him just earlier. He's looking at buying a lot of land. It's about 190 million yen in Meguro ward. And it's just an empty lot of land. And he wants to build a house that's about 190 to 200 square meters. And right now the quote's about Ichiyoku, so 90 million yen for the construction. So the total project is almost, you know, 2 million US, so 300 million yen. The way the car park is towards the north side of the property, and he wants it on the south side by like a larger road. But if it's there, because of height restrictions and whatnot, shading laws, you may not be able to build the height of the property that you want. So although the footprint says you can build 160% of the footprint, the basic calculation, yes, there could be some other limitations on it. In terms of, often is shading law and height restrictions are one that really limit what you can build. So we have to make sure that the builder looks at the property, checks all the zoning, and provide a plan that the customer is pretty happy with, and they know they can get the size. I have heard of stories before where people did just, oh, I can build 160% footprint of this land, meaning the footprint size, so I can get my 120 square meter property. And then when they go to build it, oh, there's another restriction, another one or two restrictions, which are very publicly available, and they're all listed on the actual contract of sale and item of important matters, that the individual did not go with a proper builder and get the final checkoff on it. And when you're spending 300 million yen, it's too much risk to do that and then not get the property that you're really, your dream home that you're hoping for. So that's probably the only other one, is you need to be patient, take the time and make sure. But if you do those checks, you're not gonna have an issue with the permits. It's only if you don't do the checks. I'm very confident in Japan, if you check in advance, there's not going to be something secret that they just turn you down for. That's not the case. You know very clearly, if I meet these requirements, I can build this.
Just one thing aside from due diligence is not to toot anyone's horn, but I mean, Tracy has submitted a gazillion applications for Minpaku. Blanca submitted a gazillion applications for a proper renovation to get a permit for that. Just work with somebody who's done it before. It'll save you a hell lot of headaches.
I used to have a sister helping me with the documents.
Right now, the permits you might be needing, and that's what Anton and or me as a renovation company have to deal with right now from April. And if you buy an older property, you will have to deal with that. Based on what kind of work you want. And the problem that people come across now, that when they buy older buildings, the buildings actually do not have proper house plans. So if you do not have the proper house plans, if you do have to apply for any permits, you will first have to hire a structural engineer and actually an architect to do the whole, to do the drawings and everything for you to be able to get permits for the renovations if it's like pre-1981 building, you know, two floors, all that stuff. And that it's additional, let's say 800,000 to 1.5 million yen in paperwork alone that you're going to pay extra. So those are the permits, and nobody actually guarantees you that you will get the permit. So those are permits that you might not want to be dealing with. And I always try and avoid that as much as possible because nobody guarantees you will get that. Anton said some people do it after, but you know, like, you have to be careful about that if you are dealing with renovations of older properties.
We can do one more question. But by the way, all of that works for visas as well, right? Like, you don't want to reinvent the wheel. Just work with Nick or with one of his immigration lawyers, just somebody who's done that. I now have a very good friend who's just stuck in limbo because they didn't go with an immigration lawyer. They thought they could do it themselves. They fell right over on that borderline of the new regulations coming in, and they're just stuck, which is terrible. So save yourselves a whole lot of headaches. We got time for one more question, because I know you all want photo ops and stuff, and we have to be out of here by 6. So one more question, if anyone's got it. Otherwise, anything from the stream, Alfie? No. Okay, good. Thank you very much for all of this.
So just a quick reminder, please scan the QR code, fill out the that's a survey questionnaire right there. It goes straight to a Google form.
That's so, that
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I did that. Yeah.
And this is the era.
I am fancy fans. So yeah, both of them are the same. So please scan that, fill that out. We'd really appreciate it. Based on your feedback, that's why this grew from a 1-day event to a 2-day event. That's why it grew from just 4 of us talking to now a panel of a dozen. Locations, venues, we're bigger and we're better lunches, more spread out. All of that is based on the feedback that we get. So please do submit. And as I said, 2 people here in person will be entered to win a free entry to the next event in April 2026. And 2 people on the Zoom will get free access for for that same event. And it's transferable. So if you can't attend or you don't want to attend, you can transfer that pass to a friend.
There's already 19 responses.
That's better. See, this is good. Yeah. My friend told me, put a QR code, tell him to do it right away and give him a prize.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And the events, the after party is going to be here. What is the name of that venue, Ziv?
Uokichi,
Tokyo. Uokichi, Uokichi.
Yeah.
Uokichi, Sakaba.
Tokyo Town.
Okay, and that is how far from